Chapter 12, Empire of Persia and Media, Artaxerxes to Darius Codomannus. Artaxerxes, surnamed Longimanus, the long-armed, the son of Xerxes, out of much trouble, plot, counterplot, and murder, succeeded Xerxes in the throne of Persia, B.C. 464. In B.C. 460, Egypt revolted, and Athens, to take further vengeance on Persia, joined the Egyptians. But though the Persians were defeated and their army almost destroyed in the first battle, a greater army was sent into Egypt, and the allied forces were defeated in a great battle, and the whole fleet of the Athenians fell into the hands of the Persians. Egypt was again completely subjected to the Persian power, B.C. 455. In 449, the Athenians again sent out a fleet of 200 ships under the command of Cimon. The fleet sailed to Cyprus and first laid siege to Citium on that island. There Cimon died, and for want of provisions, the Athenians were forced to raise the siege and seek some place where their efforts would bring quicker returns. Having departed from Citium, as the fleet was sailing past Salamis in Cyprus, it found there a Cilician and Phoenician fleet consisting of 300 vessels, which it immediately attacked and defeated, notwithstanding the disparity of number. Besides the ships which were sunk, 100 triremes were taken, and the sailors then landed and gained a victory over a Persian army upon the shore. Artaxerxes, upon this, fearing lest he should lose Cyprus altogether, and thinking that if Athens became mistress of this important island, she would always be fomenting insurrection in Egypt, made overtures for peace to the generals who were now in command. His propositions were favorably received. Peace was made on the following terms. Athens agreed to relinquish Cyprus and recall her squadron from Egypt, while the king consented to grant freedom to all the Greek cities on the Asiatic continent, and not to menace them either by land or water. The sea was divided between the two powers. Persian ships of war were not to sail to the west of Phasaelis in the Levant, or of the Cyanean islands in the Euxine, and Greek warships, we may assume, were not to show themselves east of those limits. On these conditions there was to be peace and amity between the Greeks and the Persians, and neither nation was to undertake any expeditions against the territories of the other. Thus terminated the first period of hostility between Greece and Persia, a period of exactly half a century, commencing B.C. 499 and ending B.C. 449, in the 17th year of Artaxerxes. The peace at this time concluded was called the Peace of Callias. In his 7th year, 457 B.C., Artaxerxes issued to Ezra the decree found in Ezra 7 for the finishing of the temple and the complete establishment of the government of the Jews in Palestine. Nehemiah was cupbearer to this Artaxerxes, and in the 20th year of the king, Nehemiah was made very sorry by the report that the Jews in Palestine were in great affliction and reproach, and that the wall of Jerusalem was yet in ruins. As he was offering wine to the king, Artaxerxes noticed his sadness and asked, "Why is thy countenance sad, seeing thou art not sick? This is nothing else but sorrow of heart." Nehemiah answered, "Let the king live forever. Why should not my countenance be sad when the city, the place of my father's sepulchres, lieth waste, and the gates thereof are consumed with fire?" Then the king said, "For what dost thou make request?" And says Nehemiah, "I prayed to the God of heaven, and I said unto the king, If it please the king, And if thy servant have found favor in his sight, that thou wouldest send me unto Judah, unto the city of my father's sepulchres, that I may build it. And the king said unto me, the queen also sitting by him, For how long shall thy journey be? And when wilt thou return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time. Moreover, I said unto the king, If it please the king, let letters be given me to the governors beyond the river, that they may convey me over till I come into Judah, and a letter unto Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the palace which appertained to the house, and for the wall of the city, and for the house that I shall enter into. And the king granted me according to the good hand of my God upon me. Nehemiah immediately reorganized the government, and gathered all the people together, and distributed them clear around the city, building the wall all at once, a certain portion of the people building a certain section. As in former times, the Samaritans were grieved exceedingly that there was come a man to seek the welfare of the children of Israel. As soon as they saw that the work was to begin in earnest, Sanballat the Horonite, and Tobiah the servant, the Ammonite, and Geshem the Arabian laughed them to scorn, and despised them, and said, What is this thing that ye do? Will ye rebel against the king? But when they learned that the wall was actually being built, they were wroth, and took great indignation, and mocked the Jews. And Sanballat spake before his brethren and the army of Samaria, and said, What do these feeble Jews? Will they fortify themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they make an end in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of the rubbish which are burned? And Tobiah the Ammonite was by him, and he said, Even that which they build, if a fox go up, he shall even break down their stone wall. But the Jews proceeded steadily with their building, and when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabians and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were made up and that the breaches began to be stopped, then they were very wroth and conspired all of them together to come and to fight against Jerusalem and to hinder it. They intended to do it so secretly that the Jews should not know of it until the attack was begun in the very midst of them. But Nehemiah learned of it in time to set all the people on the defensive, which, when the Samaritans discovered, they postponed their attack. Then all the Jews set persistently to work again to build the wall. And, says Nehemiah, from that time forth, the half of my servants wrought in the work, and the other half of them held both the spears, the shields and the bows, and the habergeons, and the rulers were behind all the house of Judah. They which builded on the wall, and they that bare burdens with those that laded, every one with one of his hands wrought in the work, and with the other hand held a weapon. For the builders, every one had his sword girded by his side, and so builded, and he that sounded the trumpet was by me. And I said unto the nobles, and to the rulers, and to the rest of the people, The work is great and large, and we are separated upon the wall, one far from another. In what place therefore ye hear the sound of the trumpet, resort ye thither unto us. Our God shall fight for us. So we labored in the work, and half of them held the spears from the rising of the morning till the stars appeared. Likewise, at the same time, said I unto the people, Let every one with his servant lodge within Jerusalem, that in the night they may be a guard to us, and labor on the day. So neither I, nor my brethren, nor my servants, nor the men of the guard which followed me, none of us put off our clothes, saving that every one put them off for washing. So the wall was finished in the 25th day of the month Elul, in 52 days. And it came to pass that when all our enemies heard thereof, and all the heathen that were about us saw these things, they were much cast down in their own eyes, for they perceived that this work was wrought of our God. Moreover, in those days the nobles of Judah sent many letters unto Tobiah, and the letters of Tobiah came unto them. For there were many in Judah sworn unto him, because he was the son-in-law of Shechaniah, the son of Ara. And his son Johanan had taken the daughter of Meshullam, the son of Berechiah. Also they reported his good deeds before me, and uttered my words to him. And Tobiah sent letters to put me in fear. Nehemiah remained 12 years at Jerusalem, restoring the city, the government, and the religious organization of the Jews. He then returned to the king of Persia. He remained, however, only a short time at the court of the king, when he again obtained leave of the king and went up once more to Jerusalem. Having arrived at Jerusalem, he found that, in his absence, Eliashib the high priest had actually installed Tobiah in one of the chambers in the court of the temple, and Tobiah was dwelling there as though it were in his own house. Nehemiah, without any parley, cast forth all the household stuff of Tobiah out of the chamber, and commanded that that and the other chambers be cleansed, and placed in them the vessels and furniture of the temple that belonged there. Also during Nehemiah's absence, the evil of the mixed marriages of the Jews with the heathen had been deepened. As we have seen already, both Tobiah and his son had married daughters of prominent Jews. But now one of the grandsons of Eliashib the high priest had married a daughter of Sanballat the Horonite. Also there were found Jews that had married wives of Ashdod, of Ammon, and of Moab. And their children spake half in the speech of Ashdod, and could not speak in the Jews' language, but according to the language of each people. And I contended with them, and cursed them, and smote certain of them, and plucked off their hair, and made them swear by God, saying, Ye shall not give your daughters unto their sons, nor take their daughters unto your sons, or for yourselves. Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things? Yet among many nations was there no king like him, who was beloved of his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, even him did outlandish women cause to sin. Shall we then hearken unto you to do all this great evil, to transgress against our God in marrying strange wives? And one of the sons of Joiada, the son of Eliashib, the high priest, was son-in-law to Sanballat the Horonite. Therefore I chased him from me. Remember them, O my God, because they have defiled the priesthood, and the covenant of the priesthood, and of the Levites. Thus cleansed I them from all strangers, and appointed the wards of the priests and the Levites, every one in his business, and for the wood offering at times appointed, and for the first fruits. Remember me, O my God, for good. Artaxerxes lived and reigned 8 years longer, and died in 425. Xerxes II, the son of Artaxerxes Longimanus, immediately succeeded his father in the throne, but was allowed to reign but 45 days, being murdered by his half-brother Sogdianus. Sogdianus seized the throne by the murder of Xerxes II, and was able to hold it but 6 months and 15 days, when he himself was murdered by his half-brother Ochus. Darius II is the name which Ochus gave himself on ascending the throne. To this the Greeks added the surname Nothus, so that in the history he stands as Darius Nothus. He reigned 19 years, but the whole period was hardly anything else than a continuous series of revolts in the provinces and intrigues of treacherous men, murderous women, and eunuchs at the court. One notable thing, however, occurred in the reign of Darius Nathus. That grandson of Eliashib the high priest, who was son-in-law to Sanballat the Horonite, and whom Nehemiah chased from Jerusalem, was named Manasseh. Sanballat, Tobiah, Tobiah's sons, and this Manasseh, all finding themselves excluded from Jerusalem and the worship there, determined to have a temple and a worship of their own. Sanballat accordingly went to Darius Nathus and obtained from him a grant to build on Mount Gerizim near Samaria a temple like that at Jerusalem, and to make Manasseh his son-in-law high priest of it. Sanballat, having built this temple and made Manasseh high priest of it, Samaria thenceforth became the common refuge and asylum of the refractory Jews, so that if any among them were found guilty of violating the law, as in eating forbidden meats, the breach of the Sabbath, or the like, and were called to an account for it, they fled to the Samaritans, and there found reception, by which means it came to pass that, after some time, the greatest part of that people were made up of apostate Jews and their descendants. The mixing of so many Jews among them soon made a change in their religion. For whereas they had hitherto worshipped the God of Israel only in conjunction with their other gods, that is, the gods of those nations of the east from whence they came, after a temple was built among them in which the daily service was constantly performed in the same manner as at Jerusalem, and the book of the law of Moses was brought to Samaria, and there publicly read to them, they soon left off worshipping their false gods and conformed themselves wholly to the worship of the true God, according to the rule which was in that book prescribed to them. However, the Jews, looking on them as apostates, hated them above all the nations of the earth, so as to avoid all manner of converse and communication with them. This hatred first began from the opposition which the Samaritans made against them on their return from the Babylonish captivity, both in their rebuilding of the temple and their repairing of the walls of Jerusalem, of which an account hath been above given. And it was afterward much increased by this apostasy of Manasseh and those who joined with him in it, and by their erecting hereon an altar and a temple in opposition to theirs at Jerusalem. And all others who, at any time after, fled from Jerusalem for the violating of the law, always finding reception among them, this continually further added to the rancor which the Jews had entertained against them, till at length it grew to that height that the Jews published a curse and an anathema against them, the bitterest that ever was denounced against any people. For thereby they forbade all manner of communication with them, declared all the fruits and products of their land, and everything else of theirs which was either eaten or drunk among them, to be as swine's flesh, and prohibited all of their nation ever to taste thereof, and also excluded all of that people from ever being received as proselytes to their religion. This is why the woman of Samaria was so surprised when Jesus asked her to give him a drink of water, and she replied, "How is it that thou, being a Jew, askest drink of me, which am a woman of Samaria? For the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans." It also illustrates the force of that expression of the Jews to the Savior, "Thou art a Samaritan and hast a devil," as in their estimation to be a Samaritan and to have a devil were to the same purpose. Darius Nathus reigned 19 years and died B.C. 405, leaving the crown to his eldest son, Arsacus, by his wife Pericytus. Artaxerxes was the name which Arsacus gave himself on becoming king, to whom the Greeks, for his extraordinary memory, gave the name Mnemon, i.e., the Rememberer. However, Darius and Pericetus had two sons, Artaxerxes the elder and Cyrus the younger. To Artaxerxes, as we have seen, the crown was given by Darius himself. At the same time, Darius bestowed upon Cyrus the governorship of the whole of Asia Minor, the wealthiest of all the provinces of the empire. Yet Cyrus was so insanely jealous of this honor bestowed upon Artaxerxes that he plotted to murder him at the time of his coronation. The plot was discovered. Cyrus was arrested and was ordered to be executed, but his mother interceded so earnestly for him as to obtain a pardon, and he was allowed to return to the position of governor of Asia Minor. In his place as governor of his province, however, Cyrus still clung to his determination to destroy Artaxerxes and be king himself. Under pretense of planning an invasion of Thrace, he employed Clearchus, a Lacedaemonian captain, to raise an army of Greeks for his service. Shortly afterward, by the intrigue of Cyrus, several cities under the government of Tissaphernes revolted to Cyrus. This caused some minor contention between Cyrus and Tissaphernes, which gave to Cyrus the much desired opportunity of gathering a powerful army with which really to attack Artaxerxes, but under the pretense of defending himself against Tissaphernes. He even sent to Artaxerxes himself piteous pleas for troops to aid him in protecting himself against Tissaphernes. Through all this, Artaxerxes was completely deceived. Cyrus had also emissaries busily at work among the governors and people throughout the empire, sowing seeds of discontent against Artaxerxes and constantly turning their attention to Cyrus. At last, in B.C. 401, Cyrus, with 113,000 troops and a powerful fleet, considered himself in position openly to take up his march toward the capital to unseat Artaxerxes. A part of this army of Cyrus, indeed the flower of it, was the 10,000 immortalized by their famous retreat and by having Xenophon to record it. Artaxerxes, hearing of the coming of Cyrus, made the greatest preparations possible and succeeded in gathering an army of about 1,200,000 men. The armies met at Conaxa, about 75 miles from Babylon. The 10,000 took the lead in the battle, and at their first onset routed the main part of the army of Artaxerxes, which fled precipitately. Artaxerxes, however, in command of his right wing, held his division of his army together, and began to wheel his troops to attack the forces of Cyrus in the flank. Cyrus, seeing this, led his mounted bodyguard of 600 directly against him, and the immediate command of Artaxerxes was also put to flight. The battle was won, and Cyrus was proclaimed king by his troops, which he might easily have continued if he could have been satisfied with anything less than the death of Artaxerxes. But catching sight of Artaxerxes, he was transported with rage, and crying out, "I see him," urged forward his horse to meet Artaxerxes in single combat. The result was that Cyrus was killed, and all his bodyguard rushed in and died with him. The main body of the troops of Cyrus firmly believed that they had the victory complete, because they had put to rout the left wing of the army of Artaxerxes. But the right wing of Artaxerxes, returning and joining the king, were sure that they had the victory because Cyrus was dead. The Greeks that had followed the fleeing Persians returned to secure their camp, and Artaxerxes, as soon as Cyrus was killed, sent out messengers and rallied all his forces. The two armies were again soon drawn up to renew the battle. Again, at the first onset of the Greeks, the Persian army broke and fled. The Greeks did not yet know that Cyrus was dead, and night coming on, they gathered again to their camp and were much surprised to find Cyrus nowhere. But thinking that perhaps he was pursuing the fleeing Persians, they rested easy through the night. The next day, however, the Greeks learned that Cyrus was dead. They immediately sent deputies to one of his principal generals and asked him to allow himself to be proclaimed king of Persia, but he refused. Artaxerxes sent messengers demanding that the Greeks should surrender. They strenuously refused. After about 5 days, a parley was obtained, with Tissaphernes as the go-between. The Greeks explained, and this was the first occasion that they had had to explain, that Cyrus had not let them know, neither when he left Asia Minor nor while on the march, that he was leading them against Artaxerxes, and they had no idea of any such thing until the time came for battle. And then, when they saw Cyrus surrounded with dangers, they considered it would be infamous to abandon him. They declared that, as Cyrus was now dead, they were released from all engagement to him, and as they had no desire to disturb Artaxerxes in his possession of the crown of Persia, they asked that he let them return to their own country. Artaxerxes granted their request, on condition that they should swear that they would not commit any violence or disorder to the people of the country as they passed, but take simply what was necessary to sustain them as they marched. This agreement was sealed by both parties giving their hands. Yet, after several days marching, under the escort of Tissaphernes with a considerable army, all the generals and principal officers of the Greeks were inveigled into a pretended council and were massacred. The following night, by the advice of Xenophon, a council of the Greeks was held, and new officers were appointed in the place of those who had been murdered. Before break of day, the whole army was assembled, the determination was formed, and final arrangements were made to march in a body back to their own country. And there, early in the morning, 1,800 miles from home, in the heart of a treacherous enemy's country, began the memorable retreat of the 10,000, to which no account, outside of the immortal record made by Xenophon himself, can ever do justice. After Artaxerxes had got rid of the Greeks, he was obliged to conduct a war of 6 years to deliver the island of Cyprus from Evagoras, who had obtained possession of the city of Salamis, and extended his conquest from city to city, and was in a fair way to become possessor of the whole island. This war came to an end, a treaty of peace was made, allowing Evagoras to continue king of the city of Salamis only, B.C. 385. The next year, Artaxerxes conducted an expedition against the Cadousians, and inhabited part of the mountains situate between the Euxine and Caspian seas in the north of Media. Some time before this, Egypt had again revolted, and more than anything else, it was the support which Egypt gave to Evagoras in the island of Cyprus that made it so difficult for the Persians to beat him there. In 377, Artaxerxes determined to bring Egypt again into subjection. He spent 3 years in gathering together his forces. He secured the alliance of the Greeks, with the exception of the Thebans. The place of general rendezvous was Acco, since called Ptolemais in Palestine. In a review there, the army was found to consist of 200,000 Persians under the command of Pharnabazus, and 20,000 Greeks under Iphicrates. The naval forces were in proportion to those of the land. Their fleet consisted of 300 galleys, besides 200 vessels of 30 oars, and a prodigious number of barks to transport the necessary provisions for the fleet and army. The forces reached Egypt in good order and had much the advantage, but the Egyptians conducted their defense so skillfully as to prevent any decisive battle until the regular inundation of the Nile, when, all of Egypt being under water, the Persians were obliged to abandon the expedition and retire from the country. About the year 361 BC, there was a revolt almost general of the provinces of Persia, but as there was no unity of purpose, nor any mutual support among the revolted governors, any great mischief was prevented by the anxiety of each one to secure the favor of the imperial forces to protect him from the encroachments of others. Thus, this formidable revolt, which had brought the Persian Empire to the very brink of ruin, dissolved of itself. The last days of the reign of Artaxerxes abounded with cabals. The whole court was divided into factions in favor of one or other of his sons, who pretended to the succession. He had 150 by his concubines, who were in number 360, and 3 by his lawful wife Attaso, that is, Darius, Ariaspes, and Ochus. To put a stop to these intrigues, he declared Darius the eldest his successor. And to remove all possibility of disputing that princes right after the death of Artaxerxes, he permitted Darius to assume from thenceforth the title of king and to wear the royal tiara. However, this did not satisfy Darius, and he formed a conspiracy to murder his father that he himself might reign alone. The conspiracy was detected, and Darius and his accomplices were put to death. After this, all the cabals were renewed, in the midst of which Artaxerxes Nemon died B.C. 361, after a reign of 43 years. Ochus succeeded to the throne upon the death of his father Artaxerxes Nemon. Ochus was the most cruel and wicked of all the princes of his race, as his actions soon evinced. In a very short time, the palace and the whole empire were filled with his murders. Ochus determined upon the reduction of Egypt, but just as he was starting on his expedition, he was met with the news that Phoenicia had revolted and formed an alliance with Egypt. This obliged him to turn his attention to Phoenicia. But the Phoenicians defeated all the troops which were sent against them. Upon this encouragement, Cyprus threw off the Persian yoke and joined Phoenicia and Egypt. Ochus succeeded in so pacifying the Greeks as to secure himself against any further troops joining the revolted provinces. He was even able to secure for his army a body of 10,000 Greeks. Then, gathering all his forces together at the border of Phoenicia, he took personal command of the whole army, consisting of 300,000 infantry and 30,000 cavalry. Sidon was betrayed into his hands, and he burned it, after which all Phoenicia submitted. Upon this, Cyprus desired to make terms, and Ochus, rather than to be longer delayed from invading Egypt, granted peace. Then, all obstacles being out of the way, he took up his long-desired march directly to Egypt. Nectanebus was king of Egypt, and with an army of 140,000, he made great preparations for the defense of his country. One battle, however, in which the Persians were victorious, decided the fate of Egypt. Nectanebus, having lost all hope of being able to defend himself, escaped with his treasures and most valuable effects into Ethiopia, from whence he never returned. He was the last king of Egypt, of the Egyptian race, since whom it has always continued under a foreign yoke, according to the prediction of Ezekiel. Achis, having entirely conquered Egypt in this manner, dismantled the cities, pillaged the temples, and returned in triumph to Babylon, laden with spoils, and especially with gold and silver, of which he carried away immense sums. He left the government of it to Pherendites, a Persian of the first quality. In 350 BC, Achis, after the conquest of Egypt and the reduction of the revolted provinces of his empire, abandoned himself to pleasure and luxurious case during the rest of his life and left the care of affairs entirely to his ministers. The two principal of them were the eunuch Bagoas and Mentor the Rhodian, who divided all power between them, and after having reigned 23 years, Achis died of poison given him by Bagoas. Arsus, the youngest of the sons of Achis, was placed upon the throne by Bagoas, who slew all the rest of the king's sons. He chose Arsus, the youngest, to occupy the throne merely that he might have one to bear the name of king while he himself should exercise the power. This condition of things continued for 2 years, when Bagoas, perceiving that Arsus contemplated bearing the power as well as the name of a king, murdered him, B.C. 336. Darius was next placed on the throne by Bagoas. His original name was Cadominus, but on ascending the throne, he took the name of Darius, and is therefore known in history as Darius Cadominus. Bagoas, soon discovering that Darius was likely to assert himself as king instead of being a pliable tool, attempted to poison him. But Darius, having discovered the plot, contrived to bring Bagoas into a position where he was obliged either to drink the deadly poison or betray himself by refusing. And Bagoas, knowing that the result would be the same in either case, swallowed the poison. Darius Cadominus was the last king of Persia, for the time was at hand when the prince of Grecia should come. And as that prince was already on the throne in Grecia, we must now turn our attention thither.